Welcome to Hub Headlines. Today's program features the best commentary and analysis published in the Hub for March 21st. Up first is Trevor Toome writing on why investing in Canada mandates would surely fail.
Pressure is mounting on the federal government to require pension funds to increase their investments in Canada. Increasing investments in Canada should be a national priority, said a group of Canadian business executives in an open letter to finance ministers. Given the importance of pension savings, they would support an effort by the Minister of Finance of Canada and the provincial ministers of finance to amend the rules governing pension funds to encourage them to invest in Canada. The government is considering options, and we might see some concrete measures in the upcoming federal budget. Many have rightly noted that mandating pension funds invest more in Canada is a bad idea. Pension fund returns may drop as a result, threatening their sustainability. And there may be broader negative effects on Canada's economy from allocating capital through non-market means. The risk of capital being misallocated is high. While such critiques are important, there's an even simpler argument against such mandates: they will almost surely fail. At best, increased pension investment would simply crowd out other investors. The overall total would be left largely unchanged. At worst, such mandates could actually lower investment in Canada for reasons I'll explain. And at the very least, it's a policy idea that distracts from real reforms that might actually help. Why would mandating increased domestic investments fail? For the simple reason that Canada is a small and open economy with freely mobile international capital flows. The supply of investment finance is, to use an economist's jargon, highly elastic. Assets here and abroad are easily substituted for each other. Investors big and small can seek out the highest returns wherever they happen to be. This has the effect of pinning down the minimum rate of return that Canadian projects need to offer in order to be financed. If one can earn a 10% return south of the border, after all, then to secure capital financing, a marginal project here must provide at least that high a return. In such a world, mandating some investors, in this case pension funds, increase their holdings of Canadian assets would simply displace other investors from holding the same. Mandates would, all else equal, lower the returns on marginal capital by increasing the overall supply. But lower returns would cause other investors to look elsewhere, offsetting the mandate's effect. The result would simply be a change in who invests in Canada without any change in the total amount of investment. In a sense, it's not the supply of capital that matters, but demand. Total investment is determined almost entirely by the availability of investment opportunities that pay, after tax, more than the alternatives abroad. There is a worse possibility, though. By mandating pensions to invest more, the government would signal a lack of confidence in Canadian businesses to secure financing on a competitive basis. Other large investors might also worry that their funds could be subject to similar regulations in the future. Policy uncertainty would rise from its already high level, as would risk premiums placed on Canadian investments. Were that to happen, total investment in Canada would fall, precisely the opposite outcome that mandate proponents wish to see. None of this denies that Canada has an investment challenge. Total capital investment per worker is increasingly lagging behind the United States. But rather than mandating more investment by some, we should look at where policy itself discourages investment. Taxes are a particular problem. After all, when you tax something, you tend to get less of it. And various governments, federal and provincial alike, tax investment in Canada. In a future Hub piece, I'll have more to say on how federal tax reforms, particularly to the corporate income tax system, could help boost Canada's economic growth and productivity. But a few important points are worth making here. Today, the effective tax rate on new investments is roughly 14%. Some sectors are even higher, with effective tax rates over 20% in construction, retail trade, and wholesale trade, and tax rates nearly as high in services. This matters. Recent work by former University of Calgary economist J.F. Wen, now with the International Monetary Fund, suggests that might have a significant negative effect on investment levels. And other research, this time by current University of Calgary economist Ken McKenzie, finds that such taxes may also lower wages earned by Canadian workers. Lower investment causes lower labor demand, which causes lower wages. Taxes not only shrink the level of investment but also bias its financing. Since interest payments on debt are tax deductible while dividends are not, businesses face a strong incentive to issue debt rather than equity to raise funds. The result? More corporate debt. If one wants to see more equity investments in Canada by large institutional funds, then eliminating debt bias in the tax system would be far better than enacting selective mandates. In short, the government should reject calls to mandate that pensions invest more domestically. There are many reasons not to, but the simplest one is that they simply wouldn't work.
That was a commentary by Trevor Toome. He is a professor of economics at the University of Calgary and a research fellow at the School of Public Policy. You can find the full text of his article on our website, thehub.ca.
Hi, Hub Podcast listener. Fun fact to share with you. Well, not really. In the coming months, Canadian digital news outlets will be able to fund up to 50% of their journalists' salaries through one form of government-coordinated subsidy or another. Here at The Hub, we think this is bad for journalism and bad for news and information consumers like you. And this is why The Hub will not be availing itself of these government subsidies. But producing high-quality news and analysis that is independent is expensive and time-consuming. And this is why we are asking you now to become a Hub subscriber for as little as 25 cents a day. Get all kinds of great benefits, including subscriber-only analysis of the economy and politics, podcast content, and so much more, all with the knowledge that your support makes our independent journalism possible. Join now at thehub.ca.
Our second essay is by Michael Kempa, writing on how crime is surging and Canadians are being left with one message.
When it comes to skyrocketing auto theft across Canada, double-digit percentage increases more frequently tied to carjackings and breaking into homes in search of keys. Recent frank personal safety advice from the Toronto Police Service has sent a clear and unfortunate message to Canadians. You are on your own. Last week, statements made by Toronto Police Constable Marco Ricciardi at an Etobicoke public safety meeting earlier in February went viral, and for good reason. Ricciardi warned that car theft is now so aggressive and so brazen that residents would be wise to leave their key fobs close to their front doors. Why, you might ask? Need to prevent car thieves from entering deeply enough into homes that violent confrontations with owners would become more likely. These thieves are armed with real and loaded guns, the constable ominously intoned, suggesting that citizens simply give up and make it easier for car thieves to steal their property reads like an admission that the police have lost control over a dangerous and costly problem. Auto thefts are exploding across Canada, with Ontario in particular becoming a candy store, fueling a rail pipeline that runs to the Montreal ports and global markets directed by organized crime. In Toronto, vehicle theft is up 150% over the past 6 years, with insurance associations listing it as over a $1.2 billion problem. The city's police chief recently stated that there were over 12,000 vehicles stolen in 2023, a 24% increase in a single year and a 300% increase since 2015. A vehicle is now stolen approximately every 40 minutes in Canada's most populous city. It is not reasonable to tell citizens to fend for themselves against such sophisticated and motivated adversaries. Organized crime expands its tentacles into all opportunities for extraordinary profit. The pandemic has created many such exploitable distortions, including human trafficking, trading in counterfeit vaccines, and coordinated shoplifting. In the case of auto theft, prices of newer used vehicles have been driven sky high due to the scarce availability of new inventory and supply chain disruptions for microchips, which slows down production. With a lucrative market at their feet, organized criminals have exploited loopholes in Canadian law to run circles around police officers. The first involves simply taking advantage of jurisdictional ambiguities and the inertia that results when multiple agencies involved in combating auto theft bump up against one another. When a car is lifted from an innocent person's driveway, it is often then parked for a day or two in a public place and monitored by thieves at a distance to determine whether the vehicle is being electronically tracked. This is most often done by private companies whose owners contract for these services. If these companies are actually able to locate the stolen vehicle, they typically mobilize police. However, if there are no suspects on the scene, these officers treat the theft as a low-priority call. Remember, they also have assaults, break-and-enters, and domestic violence to deal with. Often, thieves will then move that untended vehicle by train, which is under the separate jurisdiction of railway police. It could then arrive at Montreal shipping ports, under the watchful gaze of the Canada Border Services Agency. Keep in mind, on a typical day, there are mere single-digit CBSA agents available to monitor thousands of shipping containers at a major port. Even if police know a vehicle is in a particular port yard, it becomes a needle in a haystack. There is but a minute number of border agents literally working against the shipping clock to find it. Meanwhile, regular police are often left waiting on judicial warrants to lend assistance. The second loophole criminals regularly take advantage of is recruiting legal minors, often members of street gangs, to conduct commissioned theft. The entire thrust of Canada's youth justice system is to avoid incarcerating young people in secure facilities in favor of encouraging their rehabilitation within and reintegration into the community. In other words, young car thieves stand to earn healthy payments from organized crime syndicates while risking little custody time. When the thieves are adults, delays pending trial mean suspects are likely to be released on bail for months on end with a level of supervision stretched thin to the point of near non-existence. Canada's bail system over the last three decades has become extraordinarily risk-averse, to the point that the great majority of people across the country currently held in provincial prisons, upwards of 80% in Ontario, are awaiting trial. This leaves little room to hold many further suspects on remand. If we are failing to prevent the high volume of crime many argue is committed by a small number of repeat offenders, it follows that we must be holding far too many of the wrong types of accused offenders. Given that car theft is increasingly a repeat offense tied to home invasion and violence, we need to make some remand space for these accused in our prisons by returning to our historical practice of releasing less risky offenders on bail. Or we could entirely divert less serious cases to alternative measures, including restorative justice. Some promising moves have been made. However, because they are piecemeal, they fail to address the capacity of the range of security and criminal justice agencies needed to work together. The Trudeau government recently made car theft the focal point of its winter retreat, signaling that harsher penalties are coming in the criminal code. They also promised to make hundreds of millions of dollars available to provinces to support combating the problem, along with gun and gang violence. In Ontario, the Ford government has supported the efforts of police organizations to create special task forces and partnerships. There have been reports of some successes. Bolder action involving evidence-driven decisions about which crimes should be prioritized for processing through a prosecution and corrections system with a finite capacity would be reassuring to citizens. Public education about the sophistication of organized crime would be beneficial. People need to know that this spike in auto theft may be a shorter-term problem, requiring temporarily focused policing and policy responses until the market for newer model used cars begins to normalize. Giving citizens the idea they are on their own, however, is a dangerous message that Canadians are getting used to hearing in an increasingly disorderly post-pandemic world. Economic, ecological, and geopolitical turmoil have fueled extraordinary opportunities for organized crime to make profits and for hostile ideological opponent states and other groups to fan instability and fear in Western democracies. To the public's eye, the police seem incapable of managing the fallout, whether it is addressing opportunistic spikes in property crime, increasingly well-resourced and confrontational mass protests, or corruption where domestic political representatives are compromised by foreign interference. This then fuels a resigned public acceptance of an increasingly feudal world order, where frightened citizens bunker down to ride out the seemingly endless uncertainty. the dark but inevitable endpoint of downloading responsibility for crime prevention and personal safety upon citizens can be seen in places like South Africa and Brazil. There, residents with any resources to protect themselves live in homes hidden behind high walls topped with razor wire, guarded by panic buttons and heavily armed private security meant to deter home invaders. Canada must reverse this dark trend. We need to give people hope that the state has what it takes to secure our more courageous forays into open public and commercial life. It all starts with effective policing and community safety.
That was a commentary by Michael Kempa. He is a criminologist who focuses on exposing the politics behind policing, security and criminal justice operations, policies and reforms. That's it for today's edition of Hub Headlines. We hope you enjoyed the program. To receive all our best commentary and analysis each morning by email, subscribe to the Hub for as little as 25 cents a day. You can do that right now at thehub.ca. Hub Headlines is produced by Alicia Rao. Thanks for listening.